All right, here we go. Sorry.
Who's the best show here?
Tech Show!
Who's the best show here?
Tech Show!
All right, that's pretty good. That's the best one yet.
Pizza, pizza.
That's kind of fucking weird, but okay.
Big-O! Showtime!
Well, you were making it for young in the kitchen. I was in the dining room having sushi.
It's a little thing, Tech Show, and that's a fact. If you don't like the cast, you can stick it up your ass. Ain't no funny duddies that will link it bad. For the streaming, go direct to DLNGS.org. And IC channels at LinuxLink.net. Bound Tech Show. Just sit right there, cause the calendar's just about to begin.
Yeah. Welcome to episode 876 of the Linux Link Tech Show. On the show tonight, we have Fabulous Pat.
Happy October.
We have Gorgeous Gorkon.
Yo, yo.
We got Jivin Joe.
Hey, how's it going?
How you doing, Joe? Now you're a little hot there for a second.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll fix that in a couple minutes on the switch computers.
No, you're good now. You came in with like a slight... but no, you sound good. All right. So how's your new internet, Joel?
Yep. Well, first, before I go into that, I want to just put an apology to the listeners for a couple weeks ago. Never should have brought it up. That's all I want to talk about on that. All right. So let's talk about my move here. I moved into an apartment week and a half ago now. It's a good thing Dan had to do work last week, because I, up until like yesterday, I was doing crap at the house trying to get it ready for the buyers. But I had the final walkthrough tonight, and I think it went okay. I just got to get some stuff from my repair guy that said what he did to the air conditioner and we're good. But in any event, part of moving into an apartment, first off, dude, it's hard for me to believe it's been over 20 years since I actually lived in an apartment, and how different apartments are now today compared to what it was when I lived in my last apartment back in 1997, 98, somewhere around there. We moved into our old house in 98. So one of the first things is that I forgot, it still is a problem for apartment dwellers, is the fact that usually you're stuck with whatever cable provider or phone or internet provider that the apartment complex has their deal with, which one would think, and there has been laws passed trying to kind of combat that, okay? But part of the problem is the cable plant infrastructure. Who owns that? Okay. So in most cases, most apartment complexes, they'll work with a provider like AT&T, which is who my internet's through now, or Spectrum for cable. And actually, in our case, they just probably went the easy route with AT&T, which a lot of places, that's also called U-verse. You can get cable TV, and it uses the same kind of lines that the internet uses. Basically, essentially DSL. Although we have a 50 megabit down and probably about 10 up. It's more or less okay for pretty much. Like, I really haven't had a problem. I've been doing work for, it'll be a week tomorrow, although I'm taking Friday off. Haven't had a problem with anything with work. We've done Zoom sessions just fine. Some cases, multi-hour Zoom sessions. Just did one of those today with an incident I was working with the team. And over this coming weekend, we have another patch cycle that we're working, so I'll probably be doing it through that. So work has been just fine. And to be honest, most everything with 50 megabit has been fine. But I'm not the one that actually necessarily streams 4K video. So.
Well, who's streaming 4K video?
You'd be surprised. Netflix is capable of doing it. So.
No. I mean, I was like, it sounded like someone in on your internet connection is streaming 4K video.
Oh, not right now. No. Oh. No. I'm trying to think. My wife's TV is probably, if it's on right now on Fubo, it's probably 1080p. I think Fubo is all 1080p. I don't think they got 4K streams yet. I haven't tried yet. Excuse me. Sorry about that. But I haven't had a problem with YouTube streaming or anything else, really. It's 50 megabit, I will say, has been fine. Am I happy with it? Not really.
Would you have it in your house?
At the house, we had about double this. And the thing that kind of upsets me is that with Spectrum at the house, that's who I had at the house, it was 100 megabit and $10 cheaper. That's the thing that kind of pisses me off. I'm paying $90 a month for 50 megabit, and not when I go to the house, the new house, I can get gigabit for not a lot more money, like $10 more. And that's probably what we're going to go with when we move. So, and I'm not talking about, you know, renting the box or versus buying it, because I'm not gonna buy a box for a 6 month move. You know, that's stupid. I might consider buying one when we move to the house, but even then, to me, it's such an inconsequential amount of money on my cable bill. I don't really care. You know, so, and I only do internet.
In 6 months, you're not really gonna pay it off. So yeah, no, not true. Worth it.
Well, absolutely true.
Here's my question for you, Joe. Did they have to come and set it up, or did they just like send you something and flip a switch and say you're good to go?
Nope. Day one when I moved here, we got a package from UPS that had the all the equipment I needed, and I just installed it myself. Now, I will say this. I did have to, unfortunately, see, the thing that I wish internet provider companies would not do, but they're going to do because that's what the normies want, is essentially what they sent me not only does the internet connection itself, but also has a full-on four-port router and Wi-Fi built into it. I didn't need any of that. I have my own router. I didn't really care about that. All I wanted was a connection. That's all I wanted. But unfortunately, that's not the case. And so what ends up happening is their equipment ran on port 192.168.1.1 was their – well, it happened to be the same IP address I had for my own router. So the first thing I had to do was change the IP address to a different range on my existing ASUS router. But after that, worked just fine. So and I wholeheartedly – do not believe in using whatever routing that or Wi-Fi that comes with whatever internet equipment you get from your provider, be it from Time Warner or not Time Warner, Spectrum now with the cable modem, or AT&T with whatever their device is called. It's not a modem. It's more essentially a router that connects it to the standard phone line.
The modem router.
Yeah, and the other kind of my other beef with it too is in the apartment. There's really you basically essentially have to look for the green jack in the apartment, and that's where you're supposed to plug it in at. Well, the green jack's out in the living room, not in my office where I kind of prefer it. But what's funny though is there is a double phone jack in here, and neither of them are green.
It's DSL?
Essentially, yes.
Okay.
So.
I forgot about that. You had to. So you can't plug it into any phone jack and just use that.
You have to plug it in the green one.
You have to plug it in the green one, huh?
Although I'm wondering if I went and bought a DSL line filter, if I could plug it in here. That's what I'm wondering. But anyway, it didn't really matter too much, because what I ended up doing is I did this exact same thing I did at my house, in that I have a pair, actually I have three of them, although I'm only using two right now, of D-Link power line adapters. So you plug it right into the wall jack. You can't plug, it's important with the power line adapters is you must plug them directly into the wall. You cannot plug them in to like a power strip. That generally doesn't work. Although I did kind of cheat it a little bit, because for whatever reason, all the power strips I have aren't, instead of like a straight in plug, regular straight in plug, it's a right angle plug. All right. So basically it's flatter to the wall. But unfortunately, if you back into the top, it blocks the bottom outlet. So, which is kind of the one I need for, at least the internet connection out in the living room. Now, out in the office, that one happens to be also a Wi-Fi extender, and that can plug in at the top outlet. But they both had to plug into the top, so then it just connects just fine up. So I technically am hardwired from my work laptop. Actually, I got a router over there, or a switch over there, I mean. So I'm essentially connected right from that switch into the power line adapter, which goes into my main router out in the living room. So, and it works just as well as it did at the house in the apartment, which I'm kind of surprised with, because electrical systems are usually kind of a mess in apartment complexes. So, but it works well. Other than just wanting a little bit more bandwidth, I'm fine with it. I haven't had a drop. Although I did one time this week, I had to reboot the router because, and I think it was everything on the router. My wife complained she couldn't connect onto the internet, and she's straight up using Wi-Fi. And I look on her computer, and it wasn't getting a valid IP address, as given a 169 IP address on her laptop. So rebooted the router, and the DNS was back. DHCP was back in action, and she was able to get a proper IP address. So, but that's really the only kind of niggle I've had this week. And I have to double check and see. Kind of the one nice thing about the Asus routers is I can schedule it to reboot once a week. So I may have to think about adjusting that, maybe not doing that once a week, because I don't know if it needs it with the DSL as much as it did with the cable modem. Because I think I'm trying to think when that happened, whether it happened this Saturday or Sunday when that happened. But it's been fine since. I have to see. I thought I had it scheduled, the reboot scheduled for like 3 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday, I think. Yeah, Sunday. So I might just either not do that, or change it to a different time, or just I want to change it around and see if I have the, like, maybe change it for like 7 a.m. on a Sunday morning and see what I get up if I have an issue. So if that's the case, then I need to adjust. Oh, actually, I guess I could do the same thing. Sunday morning is just check the internet and see if I have a problem with it. Cause it ended up being on every device, so my phone was having the issue too. So, but, cause I'm not sure of how that would change on my router. But what's kind of funny though is talking to my dad. And I told him what my internet speed was, and he groaned. And I'm like, ooh, if my dad, the normie, groans when I tell him that, then it really is bad. But, you know, like I said, though, I can't really complain too much. Zoom, I'm not just doing audio on my Zooms. I usually I'm one of the ones that I like to turn the camera on when I'm on a Zoom, just because I like it, you know. So I usually have the webcam going at the same time. So, and I'm not having a problem. So, and I don't know I don't know what Zoom uses for resolution. I know that the camera I have from work is a Logitech C920. I believe it's a HD full HD camera, so there's that. But I haven't had a problem on a Zoom, so.
Yeah, I have to say, I'm pushing. Like, I don't generally have a problem with my internet connection, but right. when I got my daughter on the Zoom for school and my wife doing whatever, mm-hmm. and I'm on Zoom, and the other two are, like, I start to notice in the afternoon when the other two right. wake up and they start doing things. Like, when everybody's doing streaming videos, playing music, right. all sorts of stuff, and I'm working, you know, then I start noticing a little bit around the edges. You know, Zoom will come back and it'll get a little, like, somebody will freeze up or something for a second. But most times, I'm impressed with how well it works for all the shit that we're pumping through it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, on the other hand, this was insane, man. We have to update Couchbase because we have a enterprise contract with them, and should we have a problem, their first and always first response is you should upgrade to the latest release of Couchbase to rule out any of the bugs that we have fixed on that and stuff like that. But that's always been like one of the first things they always want us to do. So 6.6.0 came out. We're on 6.5.0. 6.6.0 came out, and we had to get the update, which means I have to get the RPM that they distribute into our Artifactory, because we run a custom Yum repo out of Artifactory, but I don't control that, so I rely on another team to do that. So I have to get that in there, and then I have to update the Chef Cookbook, because we build our Couchbase clusters using Chef in Google Cloud environment. So they're not containerized. We dabbled a little bit in the possibility of containerizing Couchbase, but it wasn't up till about a year ago or so that it was truly feasible to do that. Anyway, so I haven't touched Chef in like 6 months again. So I started messing around with it, making sure I had all my stuff, all my ducks in order. Weird thing about VirtualBox and working with it with Vagrant, that for some reason it couldn't start my VirtualBox session. Like, it would bring it up, but then it would crash. It would bring it up, and then it would crash, and I couldn't figure out why. Then all I found is all you had to do was use sudo and run it one time as sudo, like sudo VirtualBox or something like that. And then it was fixed, which is like really weird. But what would happen is when my Chef run went to install Couchbase, and this was just doing it locally in Kitchen, it would sit there and hang for a bit, and then it would come back and say it failed. It couldn't find any more mirrors to try. It failed to down again, you know, the install from Yum. Couldn't find any more mirrors. So I'm going through everything I can think of about this problem. You know, checking it out. I'm like, it's weird. Why can't I connect to our Yum repo locally? It doesn't make any sense. And I see the RPM in there. I see it on a machine. Like, I log in and I see everything tells me it should be fine. So I'm trying to debug the problem of why I can't connect to the Artifactory repo. And lo and behold, I log in, I start this session locally, and I do some Yum searching and info, and I can see it there. Like, I can see it in the repo when it comes back with the Yum info. So I tried to install it like that, doing Yum in there, and it kept coming back with the same message, right? And I couldn't understand why. And then I noticed that every time it was just getting a little bit further in the download of it. Like that line there was getting a little bit further and a little bit further and a little bit further. Turns out it was timing out through Yum. It was taking too long to pull down from our Artifactory repo down to my machine, my virtual machine that I had running for it. And that the more I kept doing it, the more it would download into the cache bit by bit by bit by bit. I even tried messing around with the timeouts and everything, and nothing would solve this. So I discovered it wasn't a connectivity issue with Yum. It was just trying to pull this was a rather large RPM down from our repo hosted internally over the VPN, over the interwebs, into my laptop over the Wi-Fi. It was just dog-ass slow. So I discovered that. Now, when I finally got the Couchbase 660 package into the repo, I ran it again today, and I knew all I had to do is just keep running Kitchen Converge until it finally succeeded. It took an hour and a half of rerunning Kitchen Converge before it finally succeeded in downloading. It took me longer to get that RPM to download and install through Kitchen running in Vagrant than it did for me to do the entire work for the cookbook and get set up and make sure everything was working properly. It was crazy, Joel. Crazy.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's like I'm going to have to probably – I'm going to try and push it to next week. But we brought out a new release of what we call Elution Messaging Assistant, or basically its job is just kind of – act as an intermediary between Rabbit and EDX, which is another piece of our software. I think I got the right combination. I know how to do all the connections and all that. But anyway, we brought out a new release, so I start working on it and trying to upgrade a non-prod environment for one of my clients. Actually, a client that happens to be right here in Ohio, believe it or not. So I start working on it like last week, and lo and behold, no, it's not working. I go to deploy it and I'm getting an error, in one of the Java, pieces that's part of this. So I go hunting through all of our resources trying to find, well, what are the requirements for this? Do we need to be on Tomcat 8? Do we need to, what version of Tomcat and Java do we have to be on? So I go to the Slack channel for this, and I had one of the developers checking on it, and it said, oh yeah, you have to be on Java 8 and Tomcat 8. So basically, one of the things I'm going to try and do next week is upgrade their Tomcat from 7 to 8 and then deploy the new version. Now, the bad thing is we're doing it via Ansible. And if I don't back up that directory that has all the stuff where I started building the WAR files for this, then the minute I execute the Ansible script to do the upgrade, it's going to fail. And it's going to basically not fail, but it's going to wipe out the directory because that's for whatever reason our procedure has us using the staging directory that Ansible also uses.
Oh, yeah, you were talking about that. Why can't they change that?
I don't know. Let's put it this way. That's in our procedure now, so that's the procedure I'm going to follow. But I'm in a position where we can change that. So that's what in fact, I actually want to do all of it in one shot. I don't want to have to deal with building the WAR file. I mean, the Ansible should do all that as far as I'm concerned. I mean, does that sound logical, Dan? I mean, that sounds logical to me,
Yeah, ideally you should be able to start with nothing and end with it with a fully functioning system.
Right. So I think part of the problem, though, and why we may not be able to do that is because in the configuration for this software, it requires an API key that's different for every one of our clients. So that might be a little bit more difficult than I thought to do.
Where do you get the API key from?
From the client. So the client gives it to us because basically it talks to another cloud-based system that we set up for this integration. So, and that's the same one that website's essentially the same website that's per both on-prem and cloud clients. So it's all the same. So, but you know, we're getting there, and I think at some point down the road we're going to look at more stuff with Kubernetes and doing stuff in containers. So, I also did some SSL work with another client this week, and we set up essentially we have two teams that handle, or actually three teams that handle this change. The applications team that I'm a part of that manages the ERP system, then another team that manages the network on AWS, and then another team that manages the identity management. And the guy that manages the ELB says, you know, is there any way we're going to be able to automate this in the future? I'm like, I don't know. Because part of the problem is our product in many ways is real, so that if you have this specific training and you're working on them, automating much, then Joe.
You're cutting out there, or am I just not able to hear it?
He's cutting out. Wi-Fi is kicking your ass.
Maybe.
No.
Am I better?
Yeah, no, you're better now.
Okay. So in any event, it's just a matter of, you know, our product's not written necessarily with the idea of cloud in mind necessarily. So it's getting there. I mean, they're making improvements to the product where we have to. And our SaaS team does a lot more things too. What would help more is if our development folks would work a little bit more with us. But
see, I'm thinking about your problem where you said that you need to get an API key in there.
Right.
And now I'm just curious about something, because I look back at now, if you permit me to go on a little bit of a segue here, because that's what we do on this show. We go into segues. Well, I was thinking about the stuff that you're doing and the stuff that I'm doing and having gone through Chef. And, like, when I first started with the company, they had their own automation solution that they rolled, which was called Site Factory and built in using Perl, largely Perl scripts, and it had a Windows component and a Linux component where you would run to an agent, kind of, so to speak, that would do the automation of what you had configured in the other part of the application. And this was, I mean, for the time, it was fantastic. It was very complex, and there was really nothing out there that was like Chef or whatever that was doing this kind of stuff. And I was just thinking, man, it was a fair bit of work having to script out a system to do like an Apache install or Tomcat or whatever. There was a lot of work involved. And then looking at the Chef side of things, or Ansible even, looking at this, and it's extrapolated a lot of the work, but you still have a fair bit of like configuration that you can do and probably have to do, like with Chef setting attributes and making sure things are working right and piecing a bunch of the different things together. And voila, you have a system once you set it up. And then I was like looking at, then I'm like, we build our containers now, and I'm like, it's just gotten insanely like easier and simpler. You know, it just feels like we're not having to do all of that all the time anymore. It's tweaking a few things in a few settings, and you deploy something with a helm chart through, you know, and of course setting up the helm charts and everything is a completely different thing, you know, you're setting that off. But I don't feel like I'm having to like build entire systems like that anymore, because it's just, once you get it in place and the automation and like with the Docker stuff has been so much simpler, it feels like. But anyway, getting more to your point there, if we, like, looking at that problem you have there of how do you insert an API key into an automated run like that, have you, like, looked at, you're in AWS, right?
Yep.
I can't remember what the solution is on AWS, but don't they have some kind of, like, for lack of a better word, like a vault or a secret service? Because we use HashiCorp Vault. So we pull that type of like specific environment / application configuration information, or for whatever, like a client information even too, API keys and all that stuff. We have it that it pulls it from the vault when the application runs. Or like when it sets up and runs the first time, or whenever we need it, or if we needed to do it in Chef, we can do it through Vault and Chef, or Scalar was a way that we had it set up where we could pass those values in through to the Chef run through Scalar, depending on who this was for, like a generic Chef cookbook, but then we could provide those specific values through the Scalar application. So do you have a layer in between your Ansible playbooks and stuff like that where you can pass that in?
Yeah. For that, not currently. And I know we're also working with Jenkins as well. So we're working on some other things with that. So
if you set up, and you could do that in Jenkins, I know you could, because you could put on right. Those type of, secrets
type of param, yeah, type of parameters, like you set it up all in Jenkins, so the API key is stored in Jenkins, and you press Jenkins, and the Jenkins spawns off the Ansible job that builds what you need. So, so we're not there yet. You know, the really what would help is if, they were developed that way from the beginning, you know, that way, you know, there's no reason they couldn't set it up such that, you know, you can go to a Jenkins site, plug in server information, even for an on-prem server, and then have it build everything you need, you know, even for an on-prem, as long as you had the right passwords and the right keys and all that for everything, then you'd be fine. So, and that's kind of one of the reasons why I'm kind of delaying it till Monday, is because I'm secondary on call this week. So one of the responsibilities I have is the stuff that doesn't get paged out, I have to go in and look at it and assign it to people and work some, as much of it as I can. So I don't really have the time to do it this week because of that. So because I'll have to go in and set up the Ansible parameters for this particular server so that it gets the new version, and I also got to make sure they have the same ports and all that. So I'm going to basically back up a directory, do the Tomcat 8 install, and then initially probably deploy. Well, actually, no, I'll probably just try deploying the new version and see if that helps. But fortunately, I can probably back up everything I need to do the rest of it. So some parts of what I'm doing with it is manual, some parts isn't. So, but we're still kind of getting there. It's just the two ERP, two main ERP systems that our whole team works with is the one I work on and then the other one. And the other one is a little bit bigger, so it has a little bit more support for a lot of things, including from the development side of things. So that's because, like, that's another problem I've been working with this last month or so, is trying to get this process working. we have a process that does a SSTP that's supposed to go out to like a third party server for one of our clients and SFTP file down. Well, that provider changed the parameters, their SFTP algorithms that their SFTP site supports. And unfortunately, I can't seem to make it work with our process because our process is based on in Java and uses Amazon Coreto 8 instead of Coreto 11 or 12 or whatever the latest version of Coreto is, and which we haven't certified with the later versions yet. So now, according to our development, oh, it's supposed to support ECDHE. Well, they haven't yet tried to figure out. I'm sure it's probably one of those things where it's just a matter of me feeding a certain set of JVM arguments into the configuration so that Java knows what to do when it sees the higher encryption parameters. Well, nobody can tell me what those are.
What version of Java are you using?
Java 8.
No, mostly. I mean, is it Oracle Java?
Amazon Coreto, okay. Which is essentially OpenJDK, Amazon's versions of OpenJDK.
Okay.
So, and we use that because it's available on both Linux and Windows in the same kind of versioning and all that. So that's the only other certified one is Oracle, and we're starting to move away from that because of the licensing that Oracle's getting stupid with licensing.
Yeah.
Especially for products like ours that has to use an older version of Java. Can't use the latest, greatest Java 12 with our product yet. It's also one of those things that would probably work just fine if we just did it, but our product team hasn't gotten around to certifying it yet, so it's like, yeah, well, it is what it is. But living in the cloud is fun, not sometimes. Pat, you shared something in the Mumble chat. The Mod Dwarf.
Yeah, I got back into playing guitar, and I've always played guitar and bass for years. I've really been doing it the last few years, but I got back into it the last year or so. So I was looking at effects, you know, the old analog type of effects. You'd spend, you know, anywhere between, you know, $50 to $200, depending on what it was. And then they had, you know, digital type boards where, you know, they have all these different effects inside them. You know, some of them would let you update the different sounds and save it. And then, you know, they would have presets. But they were pretty much closed-end systems. So fast forward to now, and it's still kind of the same thing. You still have the analog pedals, which are very popular, and you can do them piecemeal. But I don't know. I 2020, I'm kind of looking for something that's digital. You know, you do your sound, you save them, you tweak them, and you just go up, down, you know, punch in a number, and you go to the preset for that song, whatever. And, you know, you got all your sounds in there and whatnot. So I was looking at, I saw that there's people that they're doing pedal boards based on Raspberry Pi. You know, it's basically just a variation of a Raspberry Pi, and they program the circuit, and, you know, and you can do that. And that sounded like fun, but I was looking for something, you know, something I could use for, like, you know, jamming and maybe doing some home recording. And then I found an article from a friend, Jono, like 4 or 5 years ago, about this company called Mod, and they had their first... They marketed it as a pedal board, an effects pedal, the Mod Duo, and they did a Kickstarter, and it was very successful. But even though they marketed it as an effects pedal, it's really much, much, much more powerful. It's really an embedded Linux computer, you know, running ARM processor. And not only can you do, like, guitar-type effects, you know, it does that very well. You can also do bass effects, too. It has like an embedded server, like a web server, the interface. So you can plug it into your computer and you point it to the IP address of the web server. And you could, that's the editor, the web server. So inside the web server, they have all the effects. and you can tweak them and modify them and save them. You can also, it's an open system where you can download more types of effects that people and companies build for it. And it's really quite amazing. You can go to their website, have like a web store. You can see, you can hear samples, people, you know, create it using that effect. And then you can create your own presets with like all these different effects. And they have an official library that they've created. And then there's a community where there's more effects that other people created. And it's an open system where you could take an existing an effect and download the source code and modify it. It's very open-ended. So it's basically a Linux-based machine. All the effects are open. The source codes are available. You can modify existing or create your own from scratch. You can free effects. You can even, there's even a commercial patch set up where you can create like a quote-unquote premium effect and charge for it. Now, they've done two devices already. They did the Mod Duo, which was their first device, which was a few years ago. And then they had more of a synthesizer model. I think it was the X. And that one actually, besides the guitar and bass effects, they've added a guitar synth in there. So if you have a MIDI controller, you can actually play synth through the spot, synthesizers. And it's got two channels, input-output, so you can have a guitar plug-in with effects set up for it. You can have a bass plugged in at the same exact time on a different preset and everything. And it's fully made capable so that you can control, you know, what presets and whatnot you can go for. You can use, like I said, it has a bunch of synthesizers and pianos and stuff. You can plug in a MIDI keyboard and get all the sounds that are in there. There's also drum machines and sequencers so that you can go in and create like a drum track sequencer and run it into your home recording setup. It's really quite amazing. Even though they market it as like an effects pedal board, it really is a full music audio station, and it's really quite incredible. I put the URL for it. They're coming out with a new device called the Mod Dwarf. It's like the second generation guitar pedal. You know, it's going to have all the same features that the previous devices had, but it's a faster processor, and the latencies are less. Hopefully, it was first generation when they did. It was very good, and people have adopted. Professional musicians, you know, known people have been using it. It's a German company, and they're building the devices themselves, and they're doing the programming and everything, and it's really quite impressive. I was really blown away by it. Now, you can go out and buy, like, say, like a Boss guitar effect setup or, like, a Tech 21 effects pedal board that's programmable where you can go in and save the settings and modify them, you know, but they're closed systems. Whatever's in there, that's it. And those pedal boards, they have big price center between $300 to $600, $700, $800, depending on which one you get. You know, there's a lot, Line 6 is one that's pretty damn expensive, like $700. So it's the prices are pretty reasonable what you're getting out of it. The whole system, it's really impressive.
Well, you said one of those closed system ones, like $800?
Yeah.
This thing's only like $351.
It's incredible, isn't it?
That wow.
But what's really insane is like a lot of the guitar specific ones, they're marketed for guitar specific or bass specific. They're kind of getting away from that. They're kind of like, you know, you can do either guitar or bass, you know, there's presets for both. But before this one, I don't think anybody was really doing that. And what's incredible is they throw in synthesizers in there and drum machines and sequencers, and you can buy like effects with analog, you know, with circuits with analog controls, but, you know, $100 a piecemeal. Or if you get into like delay pedals and stuff and reverbs, it could be $200 or $300, depending on what you're getting. And this thing has got everything. 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 Incredible.
It's like I'm trying to remember something similar many years ago now, back when Samsung had the Q1U UMPC. So we're talking about, you know, about 12 years ago. There was a company, and I'm trying to find it, but what they were essentially trying to do is they were trying to take that QU1 or Q1U, I should say, UMPC, and basically add stuff to it and make a Linux-based mixing device of sorts. I'm trying to remember. Why can't I remember what it was?
The guitar amps are kind of split.
Right.
Like, the classic guitar amp is a two-bass, Marshall, the Fox, Hi-Wat, the Mesa Boogies. So they're tubes. So there's good and bad things about that. You know, for a while they were getting solid-state amps, and now they have some amps that are pretty much embedded computers that have all the presets in there, so all the effects are done software-wise. It's really incredible, you know, the direction it's heading. And the other thing is they have software-based guitar effects that sound fucking amazing, like incredible type stuff. It's really amazing where it is heading. You know, you've had synths since like the 80s or MIDI and stuff where you get into stuff, but now you're getting into the realm with the guitars and bass being able to do this kind of stuff too. And it's really quite exciting. It's really, really incredible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's a lot of some of the stuff our church is starting to get into with some of their media production, where we have my area, although I haven't done it in, it'll be about a month since I've done the service. I think you gave me most of October off because of this move. They knew I had this coming up. But we use, for AV, I'm not a lot involved with the audio side of it, but I do know that they're starting to use, they bought a new mixing board that's all controllable from an iPad or a tablet PC of sorts. Which our old one was like that, but the new one is so much more advanced and we could do a lot more with it, so far as audio mixing wise goes. And the same thing goes that all pipes in back to the vMix PC, which you use vMix, which is, a streaming software, and it's closed source, but it's a streaming software from, I believe it's the same company that does Blackmagic. Blackmagic, I think is the name of the company. Blackmagic, DaVinci Resolve is the video editor. By the way, you can also download DaVinci Resolve for Linux as well. I haven't played with it much, myself for video creation. But Blackmagic does a lot of software that a lot of churches are starting to use for putting services and stuff like that together. So, and then our church recently added a center placed video projection screen where the lyrics and the sermon notes and stuff will go up. And then I think they recently upgraded all the projectors. Actually, our projectors, I don't think they needed upgraded. But we upgraded it to the point where, instead of producing a standard definition video for the, lyric slides, it's now a full 1080p video, on those. So, it basically wholly revamped the whole system, that, we used to use when it was just one church together. So, and it's just a much improved experience.
Yeah, I'm going to try to get back into using our door, which is the multi-track system.
Yep.
That's still in active development. I mean, I used that application for a while when I was doing the MIPI VCAT, and that's a full-featured multi-track recording system. You know, there's a learning curve with that kind of setup. You know, it's not like Audacity where, you know, you got just a bunch of different inputs coming in and you can mix some stuff.
The thing I liked about our door, that it was pretty much, you know, once you set the tracks up, you can just record everything in one take.
Yeah, you could do multi-track recording. You could do, you know, it's very powerful. I have an external sound card, Behringer, on backorder. I'm gonna hook that up.
Get the UCA. I don't know what the newest one is, but I have one, the UCA 202, I think it was.
Well, I want to run it in Linux, and people recommend that the model is ordered.
Yeah, because this one was dirt simple, and it does work under Linux too. That's what I have somewhere around here, and it just has a left and right RCA in, so and it connects to the computer with USB. So one of the things I always thought we'd be coming is more live mixing, essentially reducing the audio portion of everything down to just a connection box to hooked up to the PC, and then the PC does all that stuff. So, but which I essentially I think is kind of what we have in a lot of cases. But they recently moved our booth where all the people were working. They moved it from the crow's nest up, that's up above most of the congregation. They moved it down to the floor because they were having issues getting the mix right. So, we're certainly on a different level technical wise in our church now that we merged, because that's, you know, it helps when my pastor is a techie and nerdy kind of guy too. I really like working with him, our new pastor. So, and my only quibble with him though is he really likes this old version of Sony Vegas for video editing, and he actually had enough licenses left. He actually gave me a copy of it, and I tried it, and I'm not a fan. I still like the Creative Cloud stuff, and I got in a conversation with Chuck Payne over on Facebook. Talking about the status of Linux video editing, and I'm overdue for actually trying to do what I do need to do is I need to record another video for my vlog on YouTube, and then I want to try and do editing like maybe in DaVinci Resolve on Linux or something else, maybe just to see has video editing changed in the last 5 years on Linux, and has it gotten any better and more stable? That was my main problem with editing on Linux in the last few years.
I haven't done any editing on Linux in a long time.
Yeah.
I'd be surprised if it wasn't a bit more stable.
Maybe more stable, but I don't think it's gotten any more imparity with some. See, that's one of the things that makes Creative Cloud itself very, very nice is a lot of the, you know, like a great example is photo editing. Now, you got some of that with Darktable, but one of the biggest problems with the open sources, especially on the photo editing side, when you're talking raw photography, not just standard JPEG editing. Raw photography depends on your editor being able to understand the raw format that your camera puts out. So, for example, I got my new camera is a Sony A6400, and if my editor doesn't support that format, then it's not going to work for me. You know, case in point, when I first bought my Nikon, I couldn't get Darktable to correctly edit a picture to where it actually looked good. It worked. I can see most of the content in the picture, but when I used a lot of the automation tools, like to set levels of the white balance level, no matter what I did, the software was only giving me a lot. It was basically giving an image that had a lot of pink in it, and that's because it just didn't understand the format that the Nikon NEF was in at the time. Now that's since changed with the Nikon, but I'm using ARW files from my Sony now, and I think I have tried them in a darktable, and it does work. But one of the nice things that Adobe has where Linux doesn't, and this is going to be difficult for Linux to compete, is that when Sony or Nikon or Canon or any of the camera companies bring out new formats, they almost instantly support them because they work together with Nikon and make it so that that format is readable and works in Lightroom. So now I will say one big kind of quibble, and luckily they corrected it, was like a year or two ago, Adobe tried to basically completely revamp Lightroom. And it was so unpopular to the point where Adobe was forced to release updates for what they call Lightroom Classic, which is my preferred photo editing on the Creative Cloud software. In either case though, it ends up working just fine with pretty much any camera I've thrown at it. I'm trying to think if I can shoot RAW on my phone. I can sometimes. Some phones can shoot RAW formatted. And the big deal with that is that you can make adjustments, and they're usually non-destructive. So, no matter how many adjustments you make to the photo in a RAW mode, you can almost always go back to the original. Which is not the case, like, if you did something like that and saved a JPEG image. Besides the fact that every time you save JPEG images, you get a reduction in quality because of the compression. So, but that's just at least my experience with the Adobe tools. And I really need to take a look at the open source tools again just to see if it's actually has gotten any better. So as much as, I know we've talked to Klaatu before, and he's a huge advocate of the open source stuff. I'm still waiting for it to come on parity, and it's going to be difficult, for that just because of the big gorilla that Adobe is today. So, and they have the industry support.
Yeah, the one I ordered is the UMC 202, the Victoria UMC 202 HD.
Yeah, I think it's the same. It might be USB. Might be the modern version of what I have. Now, for my podcast, the one I've been recording, Living in the Shade of an 80s Arcade, I've been doing all the audio editing. Lately I've been using Adobe Audition because, hey, I'm paying for it. I might as well use it, you know? Although I could probably use Audacity. But I do like...
Yeah, so as soon as that comes, I'm gonna try using that for this. I have a Samson mic. Use that as an input.
Yep.
Should work.
Yep. Oh yeah, yeah. I've done it before. I have my right now my old mixing board and that UCA 202 interface. That's all in the storage right now. But for my podcast, I've been using the Blue Yeti, which seems to be working just fine for that because it's usually just me. Although I think at some point after we end up moving to the house, I'm probably going to set up a recording area, and I want to try and have some of my friends over to do some recordings and talking about the different things that we've gone through in the 80s arcade scene. So last show I recorded was on the 83 classic Spy Hunter. It was short. It was the first one I recorded over here. So, I do need to record another episode. I usually release my episodes Saturday at midnight, usually. So, but I like recording it. And actually, if I go to the nice thing with Anchor, That's who I'm using for the hosting. It's free. And it lets me set up the feeds in pretty much every podcast, every podcast application, out there. So from iTunes to Google, podcasts or whatever. I think it's also on Spotify as well. But they let you do, sponsorships, and basically right now the sponsorship I have is Anchor. And, I have an ad that I recorded and I insert that in every show. And for the first time ever, I actually made a little bit of money on a podcast. Not a lot of money, a little bit, like $1.21.
On which podcast?
On Living in the Shade of an 80s Arcade.
Oh, okay.
So I made a whole dollar, and I recorded, what, 8 episodes? No, wait. Is it 8 episodes or 9 episodes now? I'm sorry, 10 episodes. So. In episode 9, which is a little bit longer than the last episode, if you're interested, was on an arcade game that never was.
Wait, where's the website for that?
I'll put it in the RC here in a minute. But yeah, episode 9 was on The Last Starfighter, which was at one point supposed to actually be a video game as well.
Okay, here we go. I think I found it. Yeah, oh, there we are.
There you go.
Spy Hunter. Ooh, The Last Starfighter. Oh no, the website doesn't work.
It doesn't, huh?
What happened? They're having a problem, I think.
I'll have to look.
Were they hacked? Did you play it on that website?
Should be able to. Hold on.
No, did you play it?
Oh, you mean the Last Starfighter?
Yeah.
I have in the past.
Pong, Space Invaders, Chuck E. Cheese got its own place. Wow. Wait, where did you play The Last Starfighter?
I played it, it's a free game now that you can download from Rogue Synapse and only works on Windows, unfortunately.
Oh, I thought it was like you could play it off the web page.
No, it's not web page.
Oh. Did they never, I didn't pay attention to that, but did they never have a Last Starfighter arcade game?
They never did, nope.
That was like a missed marketing opportunity right there.
Well, in fact, if you look at the end of the actual movie, it says that the video game was going to be released by Atari.
Well, there we go. That never happened.
And if you listen to my episode, one of the kind of fun little interesting...
You're too busy making E.T.
Yeah.
One little interesting bit of trivia that was in that podcast, if you listen to it, is the controller that they used for the Star Wars video game was actually being developed for The Last Starfighter. And of course, that was different than the control system they used in the actual movie. but that's, if you remember right, Star Wars video game was vector based, and a lot of The Last Starfighter was too, But if you, I do remember it was, even though it was vector based, it still, they were shaded, unlike the Star Wars ones weren't shaded at all. So.
I had that home, I had that, vector home system my brother got it. My brother was writing for the video game magazine to me. He got his hands on one, and I think the name of it, but it was really good. It had all the vector games on there.
I remember Vector. I didn't have one, but I remember it. Did that use cartridges?
It did, yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
Vectrex or Vector?
Yeah, Vector, I guess. Vectrex, something like that. But it had all the games, you know. Battle Zone, Star Wars, whatever. And they were just like the arcade versions.
Can you hear me now?
I can hear you, Joe.
Yep.
Awesome.
I'm trying to remember Vectrex, right? Wait. Is this the one I remember? Did this come with, like cells that you would put over top of the screen?
It did, yeah.
Okay, now I remember that. I'm looking at it right now. Yeah, wow. That was something. Did you have one of those, Joe? Did you have one of those, Joe? Joe, you weren't even
nope.
What was it?
Vectrex.
No.
I wonder if you could still get one. Yeah, you can, apparently.
You can. Yeah, it's hard to find.
You could buy a used off of eBay for $1,749.99.
Holy crap, man.
Yeah, I guess. Let's see. Let's look at this. Why? It says it claims to be three games mint, all original packaging and everything. So I guess there is that. Yeah, it looked to be going just ballparking, looking here, $500 up. I suspect there's not a lot of working ones out there to begin with, hence the price. Wow. Compare that with a vintage 1982 Mattel Intellivision 2 game console with 29 games. $159. Nobody wants that. Nobody wants that.
ColecoVision?
Oh. Let's see. What's a ColecoVision going for?
Because, you know, you want to play smart. You know you want to play smart.
Vintage ColecoVision game system and games untested. $28.39. Starting bid. 6 days left to go.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, trying to find stuff, of the older stuff, like, that we grew up with, getting difficult on some things. Like, even stuff that's just barely 20 years old. Like for example, one of the things that I would love to add to my collection once I move to the house is I'd love to find a B-Box. Do you guys remember the B-Box? Apparently not. B-O-S. Go ahead.
How's it spelled?
B-Box, B-E-B-O-X.
Okay.
So, and it ran BOS. All right, BOS is an operating system. It was designed to be a multi-threaded operating system and I think it was also a single-user operating system, if I remember it right, instead of a Linux-based, although it did have a terminal.
I remember running BOS.
Right.
And Haiku.
And it was started by Jean-Louis Gasset, who used to worked for Apple. So, and at the time, the I think the original B-Box or BOS computer ran on a, what they call a Hobbit, microprocessor. Which is different than what the B-Box, the final B-Box is, the one, the blue ones with the blinking lights. I believe those ran a PowerPC 604 chip.
So, okay, so the images I'm looking at have a blue box. You're not talking about the blue box.
Correct.
Where's one that's not a blue box? Is it the white box?
Yeah, it looks mostly like a beige computer.
I don't know. I can't tell because I'm only seeing the front, and it probably looks like it has the blue sides.
Yep. Actually, I take it back. It was the 603 PowerPC chip. Yeah.
What would you do with it?
The Hobbit one, I don't know what version of BOS you can run on it, if you can actually find one of them. The Hobbit processor was essentially a processor developed by AT&T. So it had the original computer had the AT&T Hobbit processor and three AT&T 9308S DSPs in it, digital signal processors. Production models, which is what you're seeing there with the blue and the gray on it. Use PowerPC 603s running at 66 or 133 megahertz. And the prototypes have duals. There's some prototypes that had dual 200 megahertz processors or four CPUs, that were never released. But just trying to find even the PowerPC 603 based B-Box is very difficult. I actually was able to find more Next Cubes than I was any of the BOS computers. So, and of course, in 97 is when they discontinued the B-Box and they had developed a BOS so that it can run on x86. So, and then from there it became Haiku OS, which I don't know how much code Haiku has that was left from BOS, but I know that you're supposed to be able to run a lot of the BOS, binaries on it. So I have run Haiku in a VM, and it actually runs very well and boots very fast. And that was kind of the most compelling thing about BOS, besides the kind of unique interface where instead of the full title bar, it just kind of had a tab on it. So.
Well, it looks like Haiku is still under development.
It is.
Just been updates 10 hours ago.
Oh, you just had it released 10 hours ago?
No. It just been updates. Like, they have a thing on their webpage.
Oh, yeah.
And it said what's new in the development. And, you know, it's more like the, not the release, but what's going on in development. What version are they on?
Beta 2.
Really?
Yep, R1 Beta 2. That was released back in June.
Wait,
it uses a package manager called Package Man.
Damn, how long has this thing been going on? It's still in beta.
Yeah, I know.
Holy mackerel.
Yeah, I think it's kind of, what's the one, Debian Herd? Remember that?
Yeah.
It's kind of like that. I think it's more of a labor of love than anything.
I thought they would have a higher number or something, like, or at least be out, because
right.
Haiku's been around for a long time.
And I have to look and see if they actually produce a version of Haiku that can run on a B-Box. I bet you they don't. But, let's see, a B-Box is something I'd like to have. The other would be a Next Cube. I would love to have an Next Cube. But even now, when that was released new, back when Steve Jobs ran Next Computer, before it went under, well, actually, I should say not went under, before it got bought by Apple, the original Next Cube, I think, was $10,000 new or more. And they're still going for like $5,000 on eBay.
Well, you can only get it on x86 architecture. It only supports that. 32-bit and 64-bit.
On Haiku, yeah.
Yeah, for Haiku. Although they do have... They have non-supported variants, which run an ARM M68K, PowerPC, RISC V64, RISC 564, and Spark.
Since we're talking about older devices, or we were, I just switched PCs again, so I don't know if I missed something or not. But I watched this video the other day on the world's smallest Windows PC in 2007, the OQO Model 02.
Yes, yes.
That thing, it looks like it was seriously nice for the time, but they were talking between 1500 and like 2300.
Price?
Price.
To get one of those? Wow.
To get one now?
No. Well, honestly, I think because they didn't sell very many of them, because they're like 5-inch screen device and it was running full Windows XP. And the one in the video, they had it running, Windows Vista. And, I'm pretty sure that the used market is probably still in the $2,000 range from what I found. But finding them working is getting to be difficult.
Yeah, it looks like they're pretty damn expensive. Can you get Linux on it?
I would assume yes. I mean, it's running a full version of Windows, so I don't see why it wouldn't run a full version of Linux. You might lose the touch screen, but it does have a USB output.
How do they get Windows on there?
With a shoehorn, maybe a sledgehammer.
Well, I meant more to the point of like, how do you actually install Windows on that?
It's got a USB port. Like a full-size USB 2.0 port on the bottom.
It's got a USB port, and in the original, like back in the day, you used to be able to buy a dock that had a full-on DVD-ROM on it.
I was going to say, I don't ever recall being able to install Windows by anything other than like a CD or DVD.
Oh, you can.
And it's got it's got a 1.8-inch spinning hard drive.
Correct. Yeah, and you can do at least with modern Windows, you can install it off of USB. Windows from that time period, no. Not that I know of. Now, I might be wrong on that because I'd never tried to install Windows from a USB port back in that time period. Probably better off getting something like a Samsung Q1 Ultra or something like that, which is... I'm not sure what the spec difference would be, although I remember there was an OQO that had was it a Core Solo? I don't know if it's a Core Solo or a Core Duo. And the original one, not paste off the newer versions of it.
Well, these are evidently pre-Atom processors, so...
Yeah. The Samsung Q1 Ultra Mobile PC starting bid right now on eBay on a used one is $50.
I found an OQO Model 2 on eBay, but it's sitting at $760.
Yeah. Well, it's like those ones in the one like the Cybernaut ones.
But yeah, if I'm paying that much, there's the One Mix One Yoga, any of those models, and then the what's that other one, other company that's making really small form factor PCs? I should know it. I've talked about it on the show before.
I'm drawing a blank myself.
Hold on. Ah, GPD.
A GPD Win. Yeah, yeah.
The GPD Win, the GPD P2 Max, even those you can get for in the $900 range.
That's not the same company that did the GPX, was it?
I don't think so.
Yeah, it is.
Is it? Okay.
You mean the GPD, like, that game...
The Win Max? The GPD Win.
No, I think he's the XPD, I think.
Okay, yeah. But they had a couple of different versions of the ones with the controllers at the top, and I thought it was the GPD Win line that had them.
GPD Win 2. Yeah, I'm looking at it right now. It does.
Yeah, actually, it is the same company that did the GPD XD Plus, which is the Android-based one that kind of looks a little bit like the Nintendo DS.
I was thinking of the GPX that I have. Still have it somewhere around here. That I had like back in 2000. 2002 maybe. I was wondering if it's the same company.
That's a handheld, a PDA?
It was a handheld, I think it ran some kind of version of Linux. I can't remember now. But it was a media player. It played games. It played videos. It was called the GP2X.
GP2X. Okay. GP2X, I just found it on Wikipedia.
Yeah. Yeah, the GP2X. I was just curious if that's the same company. Oh, no.
Linux-based handheld video game console and portable media player.
It's Game Park Holdings. That's right. Yep. So I don't know. This is a different company. GamePad Digital does the GPD.
Close.
Yeah.
GamePad, Game Park.
Yeah, I know.
Come
the other
from two
one,
different countries. One's Korea, South Korea. The other one's China.
they're practically the same country. I mean, they're nearly neighbors. Well, they are neighbors, but
they are neighbors. GPD Win and the GPD XD Plus are both from the same company, but one's Android and ARM based, and the other one's a x86 based. So the GPD XD still only runs Android 7.1. GPD Lanrao, Chinese company.
Dun dun.
I apologize to any of the Korean listeners that I may have upset with my statement.
There you go. So GPD. The only thing I don't like about the look of the GPD is having played the Nintendo Switch controller, I know right off the bat that thing would destroy my hand.
Mm-hmm.
That does not look comfortable. It looks cool, don't get me wrong, but it does not look like a comfortable... You gonna get one, Joe?
Well, one of the GPDs?
Yeah.
Maybe when they're free.
Wow, what? Like, you can get one from Newegg for $1,000.
Well,
that seems expensive.
I like the form factor. I like the idea of them. I would love to get the One Mix Yoga. I wouldn't mind getting the GPD Max, the P2.
Oh, One Mix Yoga.
Yeah, the One Mix Yoga is basically a knockoff. But it actually has a screen that folds all the way back, unlike the GPDs. So you can use it as a tablet or a mini PC.
Will they run Linux?
Yes, actually they will all run Linux.
Oh,
especially the GPD line. Oh gosh, who was it? Alan? that does all the ROMs for the GPD line. It's another podcaster that I listen to, but I haven't heard him talk about it in a while, so I'm having trouble remembering. But yeah, one of our fellow podcasters on another show, GPD sends him all their devices, and he makes Ubuntu work on it.
Oh, that's awesome. It looks cool, but my eyes don't work that small anymore. I have to wear the old man glasses to use something like that.
The GPD P2 Max is 8.9 inches, so it's bigger than your phone.
Still got to use the old man glasses. I'm getting to that point.
You got to pull out the cheaters.
That's it. When I play the Switch, I got to use the old man glasses if I'm playing it portable.
Yeah, it's almost time for me to head back to the optometrist. It's almost well past time for me to head back to the optometrist.
Oh, yeah. It stinks, doesn't it? Getting old sucks.
Yep.
Thanks, Joel.
I'm here.
Well, we gotta start wrapping this up. You need to get some sleep, Joe and Joel.
I've needed sleep for a couple of days now. It just hasn't, worked out in my favor all that well.
Yeah.
I can't go without sleep. It destroys me.
The joys of apnea. Sometimes it's not a choice.
Yep, I
agree. That's not fun. Any big things coming up, Joe?
Well, we are recording Mintcast this weekend, but we're just discussing some various browsers. And other than that, Friday, yeah, we should have another Lugcast. And project-wise, I don't know. I'm probably going to work on some DSs and a 3DS XL.
And you pairing them?
Yeah, I'm going to give it a try.
Oh, wow. Yeah. What, like,
I've been watching a lot of the Retro Future.
Okay.
And that guy does a lot of Game Boy repair. And I thought it looked like it was fun. So I think the DS has a cracked screen, and the 3DS XL won't power on. So we'll see if I get some interesting fixes out of it.
Cool. So
I just paid $300 to get everybody's haircut in my house.
$300?
$300.
How many people got haircuts?
Five people.
Five people? It's $60 a haircut.
Plus tip. It came out to like $260 for everybody to get haircuts. But they came to the house and cut the hair, so.
You know what? You could have just bought a Flowbee.
I could have just shaved my head.
Oof.
Yeah.
Well, good on you, sir.
And my 3D printer is actually working now. I only took it apart 15 times and put it back together. but it's working.
Sounds like some of the issues I was having. I just switched out the extruder to the dual gear extruder. Have you seen those?
I have not.
Yes. So basically it's the same stepper motor, but instead of just the grub screw and the either wheel, it has the main screw that hooks up to the stepper has teeth on the bottom of it that connects to teeth of very similar device on the other side. So instead of one side with teeth on it grabbing the filament and pulling it in, it grabs the filament on both sides.
Cool.
So,
let me see. I replaced the bed. I replaced the Y carriage because replacing the bed didn't fix the balance issue, because I guess the Y carriage was really bent as well. And I replaced the hot block because the old one was stripped. I replaced the thermistor twice, the heating element once. I did replace the
left channel
extruder gear, but evidently I didn't do it right, so I had to take it all the way apart again and tighten it back down, and then it finally was extruding correctly, and I've got the bed level enough that it's actually doing well. But the problem is, even with the enclosure and everything, I'm still having trouble printing ABS. But I think it's the prints that I'm doing, because they were somewhat thin, tall prints.
Right.
So even with the, you know, the enclosure, it's still changing temperature very rapidly before it can get to the next level because of how thin the walls are. And so it expands that little bit, and then it crashes, and then I get a little bit of a layer shift. So the box I'm trying to print doesn't come out right.
Interesting.
And I did the print twice just to verify, because if it was at the exact same point, it might have been a firmware issue. But it's coming, the layer shift is coming at different points. So I have to assume that it's a cooling issue. Sorry, I know I extended the
well,
show a little bit there.
No.
What are you going to do for the fix that?
I'm going to switch away from ABS for a little while and move. Well, I had some issues with PET G because I guess the center of that spool was moist, but I built my own box to dry everything out, and I've got some boat desiccant in there, and it's drying out, and that should take like a week, maybe, hopefully. And then I built another box with one of those frictionless rollers in it, and it's a sealed box, and it has one tube coming out of it, and it has desiccant in the bottom, so that way I can put my spool that I'm using in there, and that should keep it dry in the nice, humid Texas everything. So yeah, I've done a lot of work on that 3D printer lately, and it's now working, and I'm almost to that point where I should have just bought a different one, but this is still selling for more than the Ender 3 V2, which just came out and is supposed to be really good. But this should be a better printer than that, but at a certain point I gotta call it and say I'm done fixing this damn thing.
Yeah. No more haircuts, get a new printer.
I'll think about it around bonus time.
There you go.
Bonus.
Honestly, a new 3D printer would have been cheaper than giving everybody's haircut.
Well, it's like now my son, he said something about wanting a haircut, so I'll probably end up doing that this weekend, but he's like, Dad, I want to get a haircut. I'm like, okay, well, you're gonna have to wait until Daddy has more time, because I don't have a lot of time right now.
Well, part of the reason it was so expensive is that three of the people that were getting haircuts are women, and
oh, well,
it just costs more to get a woman's haircut.
Shave them all off, right?
Bick it.
Yeah.
I got clippers.
Yeah. Joel, when's your next show coming out for the Living in the
Saturday.
All right.
Although I don't know what it's going to be on. I got to record it in the next day and a half, so.
Is it still going to be tabletop, or are you going to do old school, like, computer gaming, too?
Let's see. I covered Spy Hunter. You know what? I think I'm going to talk about this week. I may talk about Road Blasters, which is an arcade game as well. Road Blasters is the Atari video game. Very similar to Spy Hunter. So.
Oh, you need to get into like late 80s all the way up to mid 90s arcade, and then I'd be interested. Start talking like Hydro Thunder, the sit-down version of Hydro Thunder, Mortal Kombat, Street Fighter.
I'm trying to stick to the 80s, man, because I'm old. And I got to add a little something there after we stop recording. I'll tell you what it's about, but I do have a little something I have to work on tonight, but...
All right, I gotta wrap this up because I do need to get to bed. And I have a feeling my daughter's up and she's got school in the morning. So here are your promos and we'll see you in a week. Thank you, everybody. Stay safe.
Oh my God, it's Hacker
Public Radio. Hacker Public Radio is a daily podcast by the hacker community for the hacker community. If you're interested in technology, creative thinking, hacking, Linux, or any kind of computer, that kind of stuff, you should listen to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.com.
Hello, my name is Matt, and I've started a new podcast called LibreQuest. I talk about Linux and general technical topics. To get the show, visit LibreQuest.org.
So we can paint anything we want?
Anything at all.
How about if I paint your fine ass? Yeah, with my tongue brush. Shut up. Just shut up.
Daddy has a gun!
It's over.
While you were making egg foo young in the kitchen, I was in the dining room having sushi.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. So how long do you think you're going to be at the apartment?
2 years.
2 years.
That's a long time.
No. Our lease is through the end of March. If everything works out okay, we should close on the other place in February.
And they'll be finished building it in February of the following year.
No, well, maybe fixing the stuff that they've screwed up. Hopefully not, but...
We stopped the recording, Joel. Say goodnight.
Yep, goodnight. Guy that did the work that says that he serviced and cleaned the air conditioner, you know, the HVAC system, which he did. I seen him do it. It looks a whole lot better now than it did when he started, so. And I'm waiting for the guy to send me that. So as soon as he gets me that, I'll send that on to our realtor, and I think we're good.
I'm curious. When you saw him clean it, did he have to take, like, take the vents apart and stuff and like get in there and clean it, or did he have some kind of like device that did?
It's just the main air conditioning system. You know, basically took apart like the heat exchanger and stuff like that, clean that,
okay,
and service it and all that. Plus, you know, the vent, like the vent leading out to all the house, that was actually just done like this summer because they had to replace the coils.
Okay. Right?
So the coils are like perfect and clean because, you know, then we only had it, that only happened like with a month ago in the summer where the air conditioning just wasn't cool and good enough. So they finally did that. That was $800 there. So, and this air conditioning system, that whole system though is like 22 years old. So, I mean, it's going to need replaced before too much longer anyway. So it's like, you know, I didn't want to put a lot of money into it. So they wanted us to clean the vents and stuff too. And I'm like, yeah, that's not happening. You know, but in any event, that happened. So that was actually one of the remedies. They cleaned the system. I know he cleaned the system. So, there was like an inch of dust on it, before he did that, and he cleaned it and it's fine. So he cleaned and serviced. Now service the system, like, okay, for me, servicing the system means, does it work? It worked before he cleaned it. So, you know what I mean? So it's like, you know, cause some of the things they had on the list were like, they wanted all the drains snaked. It's like, the drains were draining. Why do they need snaked? You know? So, yeah, we did that. So.
You snaked the drains?
Yeah.
Dude, this is not that hard. I mean, you didn't
yourself? No, it's not hard. No, we had a guy do it.
Oh.
I mean.
If you have a snake, it's not that hard. You don't. No. You gotta go get a snake or have something.
That's right. That's right. It's not that hard, you know, but the guy.
Snaking a drill.
Yeah, right. I mean, my thing, I'm gonna, you know, like, after all this is said and done, you know, a month or two down the road, I got the name of the inspection company, and I'm gonna let him have it. I wanna do a review and let him have it, cause a lot of the stuff in there was all cookie cutter. Didn't really, you know, like, perfectly, I mean, I want to say it, yeah, it probably needs replaced, but only because it's old and ugly, but not leaking, not having a problem draining, you know, but he wanted us one of the remedies they initially had on the first list back to us was they wanted us to replace the sinks, and we're like, no, we're not going to do that. That's why one of the reasons why they're selling the house is we're tired of doing all that work, you know?
Replace the kitchen sink?
No, like the vanity sinks in the other two bathrooms.
I was gonna say, I thought you just had your kitchen remodeled.
Yeah. Yeah, the kitchen's fine.
Knock yourself out, man. Fucking replace it right.
Right. Yeah, so basically they're essentially aiming to try and get almost a whole new basically a perfect house. I'm like, you're not gonna get that, you're buying a 20-year-old house. You know. And I'm not going to replace a sink that's working. Yeah, it doesn't look good, but it's working. You know, I'm not going to do that. And replace the fixtures on it, too. It's like, no. And we're not doing that, you know. And
new house. They can go crazy.
Yeah, I say after we sign those papers from Friday, do what the hell you want. I don't care.
Exactly. It's your place. Enjoy.
I mean, it's, you know, and what's even worse is they also... You know, our realtor also, we said, hey, we know there's problems, so, you know, is there anything you can do to help out buyers? And there's a warranty coming with the house. So it's like, you know, we know there's issues. That's why we want to get out.
Wait, what's, yeah. Like, who covers the warranty? Is that someone's insurance agent?
That's a good question. I think we actually lose a little bit off the top because of that. As in, you know, part of our proceeds we lose, you know. But it's not a massive amount. I mean, it's like, you know, a couple grand, whoop-de-doo-dah, you know. The odds of them, certain things are going to be covered. Certain things they already know are end of life, you know, or getting close to it, you know, like the HVAC system. Yeah, that was on our short list of, you know, if we were to stay in there, that was one of the things we're going to replace, you know. And little things like that here and there. It's like, with not a lot of money, not a lot of work, they can up the value of the house even higher than it was appraised at. In fact, they're getting a steal, because I'm betting they probably appraised it right around 170 and we only asked 155. So, I mean... You know, whatever. You know, it just pisses me off that, you know, that, this company, the guy, if you read his report, it sounds dire, you know, like, He's like,
if it was that dire, they wouldn't go through.
Well, that's right. Yeah, it wouldn't have appraised that high. You know, it wouldn't have appraised anywhere close to what they wanted if it was that dire. It's ridiculous some of the stuff he guy put on there. You know, like, you know, I have all the electrical. Well, there was okay, like two electrical outlets that were out. One of them was the one up by the front door. All right, fix that, and actually, I think we fixed that one. And that fixed almost all the other ones, because I think that one was just bad, and the ones that weren't working just started working. He didn't even have to replace those. So we replaced two sockets in the whole house. And that fixed all the electrical sockets that weren't working. So the other one I think was just a loose wire, I think, myself. I think all that had to be done was tighten the ground wire, and in a lot of cases too. You see, that's the other thing. One of the things they had on the list, he said they wanted to vent the bathroom vents to vent to outside the house. Okay, that wasn't code 20 years ago. All right, so basically it had to run a duct from my bathrooms to the outside of the house. You know, and cut holes in the wall and stuff like that. And it's like, no, we're not doing that.
Where does it vent? Right into the bedroom?
Back then, they just vented them into the attic.
Into the attic? Okay.
And then it vents out to the outside through the attic. So, I mean, it's you know, it's, you know, I'm not going to bring it to modern code. That ain't happening. You're buying a 20-year-old house.
I just say, you know, new construction.
Yeah, so I mean, it's, you know. So anyway, I mean, it wasn't that bad of a list. It only costed an additional. I mean, we grand total counting the bathroom work we did right before we got the offer, probably about $3,000 into the house since we put it on the market. So I mean, you know. But we're out. I mean, everything's out. My grill's sitting on the curb right now because I can't take it here. It's just not enough room, and I don't even think I'm allowed to use it here at the apartment anyway.
So you're sitting out for the trash to pick up?
Yeah, pretty much.
Why didn't you just ask them if they wanted it? You could have just left it for them.
Nah. Now I'm already really wanted. It's like, you know, yeah. I don't know. Some people actually want to become friends with who they sell their house to. I don't. I don't give a fuck. You know, I just want to sell it. I want to move on. It's your problem now. But, you know, and it's like, yeah. And it's definitely like, these are definitely like first-time home buyers or something like that. You know, so I mean, so it's like, you know, they don't really know what it's like to buy an older house. So that's why when we bought that house to begin with, we built it. It's because we didn't want all those kinds of problems. And we had a good run too. I mean, it was good probably 10, 15 years in before things, you know, started needed really to be done, you know. So
start the show.
Yeah, let's do it. Come talk about house shit.
All right, here we go. Need some
talk about sucky apartment internet.
There we go. All right, 5, 4, 3, 2.
Who's the best show here?
Tech Show!
Who's the best show here?
Tech Show!
All right, that's pretty good. That's the best one yet.
Pizza, pizza.
That's kind of fucking weird, but okay.
T.O. Showtime!
You were making it from young in the kitchen. I was in the dining room having sushi.
It's a little thing to make sure.
Wait a minute. Hold on. Why is that so terrible?
Yeah, it's not a little blown out.
Yeah.
What is going on there? Hold on, let me.
Like the gain was just shot through the roof.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, why is that? Let me double check.
Turn it down.
Why is that? It shouldn't be that loud. output. Okay, playback. Let me drop this. Let me see if any of this.
It's a Losing Tech Show, and that's fact. If you don't like gas, you can skid up your ass.
Yeah, what? Is that a link at that?
For the stroke, we're moving to DLNGS.O. And there you go. And I'll see you tell who's a Linux link down there. Tech Show.
Just sit right there, because the camera's just about to begin. I wonder what happened.
Still a little bit blown out, man.
What's going on? Let me try this.
It's a little thing to show.
There you go.
When that's fact.
Alright.
If you don't like the cast.
Wow. I wonder what that happened.
Did it just die?
Did what just die?
The recording or?
No. I don't know why the sound was so off like that. That's really weird. It never messed with that.